What's going on, Dash and the Millers? I've got an awesome guest for you this week. We're going to be talking about his life growing up in Philly, some health issues that he had to overcome as a young man, his YouTube career, and his life as a freelance filmmaker and director, and his new documentary, Journey to the UFC, Joe Pyfer. Please welcome my dear friend, Mr. Chandler Henry.
Over here.
It's a journey over here.
Yeah, well, man. I'm excited that you're here today, and we're going to get into your life story. I want to talk about your childhood, and I want to talk about everything you went through, how you got into film, and where you are today.
Sweet.
Sound good?
I'm an open book.
Okay.
I'm an open book.
Okay, so start me off growing up. Where'd you grow up?
I grew up in the Philadelphia area. I can't say I grew up in Philly. You know, people who see this from Philly will be like, he didn't grow up in Philly. But people who don't know the area, I'd say Philly because it's the big city, but I grew up in the suburbs of Philly.
Okay.
In an area called Media.
Okay.
Very normal childhood. Two brothers, one sister. I'm 6'9", my brother's 7 feet tall, so sports were very, very, very big in our family. But yeah, very simple Christian family upbringing. I think I had a very good childhood.
Wow, that's amazing. Your brother's 7 foot tall?
Yes, he is.
Wow, I didn't think anybody was actually going to be physically taller than you.
No, it's funny because Whitney and I, my wife Whitney, we were joking about it the other day. She's 5'8", I'm 6'9", but her sister's 6 foot, and my brother's 7 foot. So like, Whitney and I are both pretty tall, but we both have taller siblings.
Yeah.
So I feel like my kid like could be a 7 footer maybe. Yeah. Maybe. I don't wish that on him though.
No, that would be sick though. I wish I was 7 foot for sure. So tell me about what was Philly like when you were growing up going to school. Like you were in the suburbs of Philly.
Yeah.
You're not in like,
I didn't
like
grow
downtown.
Up in the mean streets.
Yeah.
I've been to the mean streets because of, you know, the work I do with some fighters in Philadelphia.
Yeah.
Seen some stuff in Philadelphia, but I did not grow up in any sort of trauma.
Dude,
I did have someone break into my house in the suburbs. That was fun, but you know, nothing.
That's crazy.
Nothing too serious.
No, dude, the videos I've seen of Philly, dude, like downtown.
This, but Sammy O, he's Joe's coach.
Yeah,
he was in the documentary. He ran for state senate a few years back, and I helped him make like commercials for his run. And he took me through the Kensington Row.
Is that the bad spot, Kensington
Row? It's the worst spot. It's where the people are zombie, like, you know.
Yeah, it's
they call it, like, fent walking, the fent lean.
Yeah, the fent lean.
They're bent over. I saw some horrible video where it's like, if you want to reserve your parking spot, just have your friend go stand in the parking spot and hit a fent lean. And no one will come close. And then you can...
you
and
can
the video
fart.
Had someone demonstrating, yeah, his friend just doing a fent lean in the parking spot. And bam.
Then you got one.
You got held your parking spot.
Oh, well, if I ever visit, now I've got something in my back pocket.
Yeah, people stay away from you if you're hitting the lean.
Hitting the lean,
but,
dude.
No, Sam had me. He was like, I want to show that I'm not afraid of the mean streets of Philly. Like, I'm going to walk through, like, Kensington Avenue, like, where the worst of the worst of it is. And I was like, if you're walking through it, that means I have to, too, right? Because I'm filming. He was like, yeah, you'll be fine, though. I have my big, expensive camera following him walking through the Kensington Street, and he's like... He's just kind of like looking at people like, I'm not afraid.
Oh,
and then
gosh.
some unfortunately homeless individual came up and like put his finger to the back of my head and said, I had to blow your head off. And I was like, Sam, let's go home.
Oh, my gosh.
And I was
to you
out there. Oh, yeah.
To you?
But I didn't know it was his finger at first. So I was like,
oh, my.
I was about to see black for a second.
Dude, seriously,
though. It's dangerous out there. And I think I'm getting way off topic really quick.
That's all right.
But
it's part of the
funny
deal.
Is that the number one thing I noticed when I was in those areas of Philly is there's just no cops.
At all.
There's no police presence. They won't go in there.
They just know it's overwhelming.
Yeah, there's no reason to go in there. You're not going to stop anything. There's just too many. Yeah, there's just no police presence in those horrible areas.
Wow. Which is, I guess, the spot where they need it most. I mean,
yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah.
It's a complicated issue.
Just let them have that spot.
Yeah. Just.
But I didn't grow up in that area.
Yeah, okay. I gotcha. That's downtown bad spot. I gotcha. So what was school like? What were your interests growing up? Were you always interested in like...
Always interested
media?
In sports, always interested in like, you know, I'm obviously in film now, you know, in school, I think that me and you were pretty much the same age. Like
yeah.
Growing up, sometimes there'd be class projects where like, okay, you can do a skit, you can make a diorama, or you can make a video.
Mm-hmm.
And me and my friends would always be the ones making the videos and
yeah.
I'd be filming and editing them. Like there's some stuff on my Facebook that probably needs to be deleted out of fear of cancellation of me and my friends making like Dr. Phil spinoffs and Lady Macbeth spinoffs and like
sounds amazing.
Yeah it's I always did stuff like that, so I enjoyed making videos and I guess telling stories that way in school.
Yeah,
played a lot of sports. Pretty
normal. What kind of sports?
basketball, obviously. Okay. That was,
that's a gimme.
I think my first love was football.
Yeah.
And my dad raised me a Dallas Cowboys fan in Philadelphia.
Wow.
Yeah.
Which what was a plot twist that is.
Yeah. No, that was interesting. I don't really care about the Cowboys anymore, but growing up, I was diehard. I would be coming to school in the Cowboys jerseys, all that.
Really? Are you a Birds guy now?
I am. This is going to sound like douchey cliche, but since I've like worked in sports for, I guess, like almost a decade now, I don't care about the teams as much. I get more like rooting for individual players. Mm-hmm. You know, like I was trying to explain to my dad one time. I was like, okay, so you're a Cowboys fan. You like Dak, you like Micah Parsons, you like this guy. What if they trade them all to the Eagles the next day? Wouldn't you root for the Eagles because your guys were on there?
Yeah.
Like, those are your guys. Like, so I just follow more the players and the individuals and hope that they do well and, you know, maybe gamble here and there.
Okay.
On which team I think is going to win.
Okay.
My rooting interest is FanDuel. No, I'm kidding. My rooting interest is my bank account.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I like the idea of following a player.
Yeah.
Better than I do just following a specific organization.
Like if I like this guy and he gets traded and it's not his fault, he gets traded to their team, like, what am I going to do? Hate him now because he's wearing green?
No, you can't. You got to root for him. You got to root for your boy.
Exactly.
Nice. Nice. So talk to me about when you got sick and all that stuff during school. This is right in your high school age.
Yeah. Correct? Yeah. So I, my sophomore year of high school, I was pretty good at basketball. And then the summer going into my junior year, I was playing in the AAU circuit a little bit, doing pretty well. And then at this camp that I go to every summer, it's a Christian resort. It's actually where I met my wife. You just play sports there all summer.
Wow.
And I got a food poisoning while I was there called C. diff.
C. diff.
Yeah, that's what they call it. The long name is, it's like one of those.
It's a lengthy
20 syllable microbiome diseases. But it's like people have heard of Salmonella and E. coli. It's like the super villain of all, you know, food poisoning. So C. diff kills a lot of people. And let's see, when I was 15, I was like 6'8", 220 pounds. And I got down to 140 in the hospital when I had C. diff.
140?
So, yeah, so I got it, and I was just throwing up constantly. Obviously, the other end too. Just
no doubt.
Violently, violently, like sweating, shaking, so sick. And it didn't go away for like 2 weeks. Then I had to be hospitalized for it. Spent my 16th birthday in the hospital. And then, like I said, I got down to 140 pounds. And that was going into my junior year of high school. So I couldn't go to school that whole year. I took a year off.
Full year?
Full year, yeah. I wasn't in the hospital the full year, but I was kind of in and out repeatedly. And then as I, you know, the main thing that saved me was my mom, in that I remember at one point in the hospital, they wanted to remove basically, I think it was a half of my large intestine, which they do when people have really bad infections. Sometimes that won't go away. They just take it out. My mom was like, he's 15, or I think it was 16. We're not removing his intestines. No. And she took me out of the hospital on her own will and basically started giving me like just the most basic foods you can imagine, like bone broth and lots of natural antibiotics, like not, because one of the things that really messed me up was this medicine called Cipro, which is a very intense antibiotic. It's probably, I think, the strongest one out there. And I had it in IV, I had it in pill form, and it kind of ruined my gut permanently. But my mom kind of got me better over time by like, I was only eating like two foods, like chicken and like some blueberries.
Wow.
And having a lot of stuff like oil, oregano, coconut oil, and all this stuff. And surely, slowly over time, I kind of got better. I still, to this day, only eat like eight foods, but I'm healthy now. So it's been a process since I was 16. I'm 29 now. So it's been 13 years of dealing with it. And I really only figured it out like 2 years ago on how to like function correctly.
2 years ago.
Yeah, it's a roller coaster. Like, we'll get into my stuff with the UFC that I've worked with in the past, but it's funny. I'll see myself in the background of like some UFC stuff because I was there a lot, and I'm like 160, 170 pounds. Now I'm like 230. So you can imagine I was really skin and bones. There's some pictures where I'm like,
initially,
I forgot that I was that skinny.
Initially, you almost lost 100 pounds.
Yeah, yeah.
That's crazy. Yeah. How do they actually treat it, though? What is the treatment that you're going through in the hospital?
It's changed a lot since it happened to me. I think because of situations like me,
mm-hmm.
the medicine that really, C. diff is recoverable. Some people die from it, but it's mostly older people or people who can't take it. The main reason why I was fine, and I put fine in air quotes because I wasn't fine, but the main reason I survived is because I had so much weight to lose.
Yeah.
You know, but the main thing that screwed me up is they gave me this medicine called Cipro, like I said, which it's not used anymore. And there's a lot of lawsuits involving it because it's such an intense antibiotic that it makes some people blind, makes some people paralyzed. It causes people serious damage. When I look at some of these other cases, I'm like, man, I kind of got off easy.
Wow.
Because I can still eat my steak, you know?
Absolutely.
But there was actually a recent story where a doctor, he felt so guilty because this one patient of his had Cipro and went blind, and she ended up killing herself because she hated her life so much because she had Cipro. And the doctor took Cipro to kind of like prove that it was fine.
Yeah.
And I think he ended up killing himself because it really messed him up too. He felt so guilty.
Really?
Yeah. I because it was that bad. That, but I saw the article on it about a month ago. My wife will send me updates on Cipro because it's a crazy medication.
Dude, I've never even heard of it.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
You get that virus. It's a virus?
Yeah, it's a food poisoning. It's a bacterial food. Infection. Yeah, from food. And then basically the reason I should have explained this better, that C. diff is very hard to kill. Oh. So how they treat it is they're doing a full court press of intense antibiotics, intense. So
it lingers. You know, it lingers.
If people are listening and are aware, I was on Flagyl, Rifaximin, Cipro, and like three other antibiotics. They just were throwing stuff at me to try and kill the infection. And the Cipro did kill the infection because I would be dead if I didn't get the infection gone. But it's kind of like nowhere near cancer. I'm just making an analogy. It's nowhere near cancer, but how chemo, they say that like chemo is killing you in the cancer, and it's you're just hoping the cancer dies first. Yep. So like the antibiotic in the same sense is broad spectrum. So it's not going in your body and only kill the infection. It's going in your body, killing everything.
Yeah.
And that can cause a lot of problems for people.
Wow.
Like myself.
The first guest on here, Steven, my buddy Steven, he was explaining how when he was going through chemo, we saw our mom go through chemo. It kills you. Like it's killing you, and you're just hoping it kills the cancer first and you can kind of hang in there.
My wife's dad has cancer. He currently has it. Yeah. You wouldn't think it when you know him.
No.
I
didn't think it at all.
Stage four. Like we didn't think he was going to be at our wedding at one point, which was 4 years ago, and he's still kicking strong.
Dude.
Yeah, no, he's a prime example right now? Of how having muscle mass.
Dude, he looks great.
Yeah, he has. Have you ever seen the commercials for the Camp Lejeune cancer?
Uh-uh.
Oh, well, we'll get really off topic there. But basically, he got it when he was a Marine stationed at Camp Lejeune. There was infected drinking water, and there was this huge class action lawsuit.
Oh,
basically, all these Marines that got cancer from being stationed at Camp Lejeune for the Marines when the drinking water was infected. But that being said,
that's crazy though.
That being said, he, he looked like he was going to die when he was doing the most intense chemo.
Yeah,
and then
sure.
Now that he's on like a more maintenance based, he looks fine, but it really like chemo kills everything.
Yeah. It jacks
you just
up.
Hope that it kills the cancer first.
It jacks you up. Well, I'm glad that you overed it. Here you are.
Yeah,
it's amazing. Exactly. So when you started to eat clean, though, that kind of saved you.
Yeah, for sure.
Eating
for sure.
Like very, very minimal foods.
Yeah, and I think that the past 10 years, because that got me better originally, has been just experimenting with different combinations of food to see what helps the most. Because it just seemed like no matter how simple what I was eating was, there would still be flare-ups. You know, lots of my work trips when I came out of college and was like going on the road to Vegas and stuff like that, I would just not eat for the whole trip.
Wow.
Because I was so afraid that I would get I would just get food poisoning symptoms out of the blue all the time.
Yeah, I can't even imagine.
Like I was afraid to get on planes, afraid to get on in cars with people because I was like, what if I have to throw up? What if I have to run to the bathroom? So I would just be like, all right, well, I just won't eat for a week.
And you didn't?
No, I didn't.
Dude.
Yeah, I've gone like 21 days without food. You know, I've done long, long fast to try and like fix my gut. And now I eat a ton of food. But it's like the same combo every single day. And it's been really good for me.
Good, man. I'm glad you got it figured out. At Costco meat department.
Costco.
Dude, that's that the
Costco,
way.
That new Costco in Stewart has changed my life because I would go down to West Palm Beach to hit that Costco, which is a long trip.
For sure, dude.
And now I'm like, we're going to Costco after this podcast. We literally are going to Costco after this podcast.
Yeah, it's amazing.
Yeah, and it's funny. So I have chicken for breakfast, chicken for lunch, and steak for dinner. And in between, I just have a ton of freaking grapes.
Dude.
But I'll go to checkout at Costco, and I'll literally have these packs of 6 crates of grapes, and I'll get 4 of them. So like 24 crates of grapes, and I'm checking out with a whole cart full of grapes. And they're like, you can't resell these. Because you're not allowed to because it's such good prices. Yeah. Like, they think I'm going to like go and resell the grapes for more. And I was like, I eat all of these.
Like, no, dude, I'm eating every single one. This will last
me 2 weeks, maybe.
Dude,
so
going hard on the grapes.
You freeze your grapes or like freaking candy.
Oh, wow.
And dude, let me put anyone who's listening to this on to cotton candy grapes. You've had cotton candy grapes. It will change your life.
Never had that.
You never heard of? Okay, so a cotton candy grape is a green grape crossbred with a red grape. And
they had a baby.
Yes. They bred these two grapes together, okay? And the box literally says, I can't believe it tastes like cotton candy grapes.
Wow.
That's like the name. And you bite into it, and it tastes like cotton candy. And you think, this is going to kill me. This tastes like they probably put a sugar shot inside this grape.
Yep.
All natural.
All natural.
All natural.
Amazing.
It tastes just like cotton candy. I gotta so you freeze them, freaking live off.
I got to try that out. So back to your high school days when you were sick and recovering.
Mm-hmm.
So tell me about how you met Joe. And that'll kind of lead us into the documentary.
Joe Pfeiffer's one of my best friends. He's in the UFC. I think he's ranked like 16 right now. He's got a big fight coming up on October 4th versus 14th in the world.
Yeah, we're rooting for him.
Abus Magomedov, I believe is how you say his name.
Magomedov.
Yeah, he got one a Magomedov last name.
Yeah.
He's an intimidating guy. He's got a lot of knockouts. He's a very talented guy. Big record, but.
Cool. Now we're rooting for him.
I like Joe's chance versus any human being walking planet Earth. But no, Joe was a year younger than me. And then we ended up, since I got held back when I was sick, we ended up being in the same grade. So it was my second junior year, so to speak. Hmm. And Joe was new to the high school. He had just moved from New Jersey. So we were both like the new kid at school the same year. So we hung out together a lot. We mainly ate lunch together in the library. You know, I don't want to say I didn't have any friends in high school. I had a lot of friends in high school, but I didn't really, I don't know. I wasn't into that like drinking, partying scene at all.
Yep.
Obviously because of my diet.
Yeah.
Right. Even if I wanted to be, I wasn't.
Out of necessity.
Yeah. I couldn't do that stuff. And Joe was wrestling and taking his MMA training very seriously. So he wasn't drinking or he was basically eating almost like I was.
Yeah.
Because he was, that boy knew since he was a young age that he wanted to be a professional fighter. So he was going hard at that stuff back then. So we kind of bonded over that aspect of our lives and, you know, some other similar trauma type things where we just became good friends. But throughout high school, I wouldn't say we were like really close friends. We were just mainly like good friends. And then when I went to college, he went right into MMA. So he didn't go to college. I know he was looking at a few colleges to go for maybe wrestling because he was a very, very talented wrestler. And he went straight into amateur fighting and then professional fighting. And if you look up Joe's early fights, dude, the stuff he was doing to people was like inhumane.
Really?
It's terrifying. Like when you see some of the best fighters in the world, it's funny because you know they're going to be great because when they're fighting people who aren't, like when a UFC fighter is fighting a UFC fighter, it's going to be a good fight. They're going to be somewhat evenly matched. When you have someone who's going to be a UFC fighter and they're on the amateur scene versus guys who are amateur fighters, like obviously Joe was an amateur fighter too, but like
he was killing him off.
Yeah. His first career fight ended in 17 seconds and the guy took 6 minutes to wake up.
Oh, dude.
Yeah, so he knocked him. Thought he
killed
out.
Him?
Yeah, no. It was, for real? It was bad. The guy never fought again. There's Joe's rise to the UFC, there's a lot of fights. I wish he would know off the top of his head, but where basically he ended that person's career of fighting. Like they fought Joe and they're like, yeah, this isn't for me.
It happened more than once.
Oh, I think it was like 5 or 6 times versus Joe was someone's last fight because he knocked them out so badly.
Wow.
They were just like, yeah, I can't be doing this anymore.
Dude, that's crazy. His story's nuts.
Yeah.
I listened to his whole Sean Ryan episode. That was actually amazing.
Yeah, he's had a wild, wild upbringing. So what happened was I had done a lot of magic tricks. My brother was a professional magician. He would do parties and stuff like that. So he taught me the ways. I knew some stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And then we ended up starting a YouTube channel together when I was in my first year of college. And it kind of took off, kind of was popping off. And how that equates to Joe is Joe would be getting these absurd knockouts and I would be in college and I'd be showing all my friends. I'd be like, yo, my friend's fighting tonight. It's on Instagram Live.
Yeah.
And it's just like 360p, the most blurry footage ever. And you're just seeing Joe kill somebody. And I had the thought then, I'm like, man, I got some nice cameras. Like Joe's getting these obscene knockouts. And my thought wasn't to make a documentary or anything on him. My thought was just like, this needs to be seen better.
Dude.
Like people need to see how he's killing these people.
Yeah.
Because the footage was kind of sucked.
Wow.
So when I came home that summer, I hit him up and I was like, yo, we should film some stuff together.
Yeah.
So I ended up filming a couple like short promos with him, and I knew about how rough Joe's upbringing was because I knew about it in high school, but I didn't really know the depths of how bad it was. It was very broad. Joe was very private about what had happened to him growing up.
He didn't complain about it.
No, yeah. Not really. No, it was just life. That's just life. And he obviously wasn't with his dad anymore, who was a big part in the trauma that, you know, from what I understand, he had growing up.
For sure.
And I remember we were doing a promo for his fight, and I sat him down and was interviewing him, kind of, I guess, like this, except it wasn't a podcast setting. Mm-hmm. And I just started prying deeper, and then I was like, dude, I'm going to make a movie out of this.
Wow.
He's like, what? And I'm like, yeah, I think I'm going to make like an hour-long thing if you let me. And I was like, I want to go for it. And he was down, and he trusted me to do it. And then I interviewed his coach, multiple coaches. And then I remember specifically when I was like, I knew I had something special, was I was getting all this really amazing footage of Joe. And I was kind of like a kid in a candy store, because on YouTube, you're filming a lot of talking head videos. I was obviously filming myself do magic tricks and things like that. But when I was filming Joe, I was like, this is so cool. Like, the footage is so cool. And I love editing together, like, basically, like, music videos, like, cool moments. But I was doing a lot with magic tricks. And it was like, man, stuff's kind of corny. Mm-hmm. Like, I was doing these huge beat drops on, like, magic tricks. And I was like, man, doing that on a knockout's a lot freaking cooler. Mm-hmm. So I just kind of became addicted to, like, making these awesome promos. And then I'm doing these interviews, and Sam, Joe's coach, his name's Sam Morapiza. He fought Bellator, basically a UFC fighter before UFC was super, super popular. And he brought me a flash drive and said, you got to look at this flash drive. And I opened up the flash drive, and it was like 50 plus hours of home video of Joe training MMA since he was 2 years old. And I was like, oh shoot, this is a gold mine.
Wow.
I don't think that they even understand how awesome this is. Cause when Joe's like a UFC champion, no one else has this. No one else has a backlog. Cause his dad was recording him, training him all these years. And it's pretty brutal training. There's some messed up stuff on those videos, mm-hmm. like of abuse and stuff like that. But besides that, it's like, there's literally a shot of Joe putting on the sparring headset, the headgear at like a year and a half old, sparring his sisters. And I'm like, dude, this stuff, the transitions I could do with this,
it's gonna be amazing.
Yeah, so I end up making this documentary. I had like an ultra book it was like a really cheap laptop, couldn't really edit videos, but that's what I was doing my YouTube videos on. And I remember I would have to, like, when I finished it, I had to do all these sort of tricks to just get my computer to edit it. Mm-hmm. And then when it came to like export the whole documentary, like, it could only do it in 5 minute segments. So I export it 5 minutes at a time, took like a week, and then I stitched those together and then exported that, and then uploaded it to YouTube and showed Joe and Sam and Harmon, who's his other coach, and they were like, dude, we were not expecting this. And
it's professional.
I kind of knew it was good.
Yeah.
I kind of knew it was good back then, but I wasn't hyping myself up too much because I just thought I landed on like one of the best stories ever.
For sure.
Now, keep in mind, back then, Joe wasn't in the UFC. He was just a professional MMA fighter trying to make his way to the UFC. So you haven't seen this documentary. This is back in 2018, 2019.
This is not the one that I watched the other. Oh,
yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
It's completely different.
Completely different. Oh. I made it. It was on one of these cameras, same cameras you got set up here.
Wow.
I made it on that. And I was still in college, and I posted it on YouTube, and I really didn't know what to do with it. I was just like, I just made this documentary, and I literally just... My YouTube channel had close to 100,000 subscribers back then, and I just posted it on there, and it got some views, and I posted it on Facebook, and it got some views there. And then I remember I was still going to school for video editing, and I could not stand my classes because they were teaching me stuff that I already knew. And I don't say it to say like I'm some video editing prodigy. It's just all the stuff's on YouTube, right? So I had taught myself how to edit on YouTube. Then I would go sit in class, and they'd be like, here's how to keyframe a clip. And I'm like, I've known how to do this for 3 freaking years.
Mm-hmm.
It's not hard.
No.
So I ended up talking to my teacher, and I was like, hey, I made this documentary this summer. It's got some views. Like, what should I do with this? Where should I put it? And he was like, I got some competitions you could put it into. And he put in a competition for me, and it won second place for documentary of the year. It got beat by one other documentary that was made by 21 people. It was called Team 21. So it was a team of 21 people who made this documentary. They beat me out. And I was like, that's pretty good for my first one.
Yeah, that's really 100%
good. 100% on my own. So to fast forward, I've been talking a lot here, but
forward. No, I love it.
A sports agent found the documentary on Facebook and he was an MMA agent. He was like, how does this, I'm quoting him here. He was like, how does this fighter have this professional documentary made on him? Where's the money coming from? Like,
yeah.
They don't know I do this for free. Like, he's like, this is a professional documentary. Like, where's this all coming from? And they looked Joe up and they came to his next fight. Joe won in the first round. So they end up signing Joe to their sports agency. And then they, in theory, like the next week signed me to be their, like their sports documentary person for this big sports agency in Texas. So the documentary landed Joe an agent and it landed me a job right out of college. You know, I think Joe would have ended up with an agent no matter what.
Yeah, he's very talented for sure.
Yeah, I don't think took a, you know, a genius agent to be like, oh, that guy's got some talent.
Yeah.
I think he would have ended up selling regardless of my documentary. But as the story goes, yeah, that is how this specific agent found him.
Found him.
Yeah.
Wow, that's awesome. So I do want to, I want to deep dive in the documentary, like how you made it and just how you kind of put everything together.
Yeah.
But I want to talk about your YouTube career.
Yeah.
Because that interests me too. Not that I'm going to be like some YouTuber, but maybe we can learn some tips, like the ins and outs of how to kind of keep it successful and maybe some hidden tricks.
So for YouTube, YouTube, when I started it in 2016, is a literal different beast than it is today.
How so?
In a good way.
Oh.
It's never been easier to become famous on YouTube in my eyes.
Than today? Really?
Now, is there a ton of people trying to become a YouTuber today than there were back then? Yeah.
Yeah.
There was some survey that got a lot of traction where they surveyed like kids on what they want to be when they grow up, and like 35% of them say YouTuber or 100%. Influencer of some sort.
Yeah, a bunch of people.
So do. Like, it's a very oversaturated market. But back then, you're only getting views. If you have no subscriber base, you're only getting views based off people searching for your content, like actively going YouTube search bar. I want to learn how to do this. I want to watch this. And I basically, we made magic trick tutorials, me and my brother, and like magic performances. So like there's videos on YouTube of us walking the streets of Philly, showing all these people magic tricks and them freaking out. Ocean City, New Jersey, showing them magic tricks and them freaking out. You don't know about this?
No, you did all that?
Yeah. They're still on YouTube.
How awkward is it to just walk up to people and like, hey, like here's
this. Oh, it's awkward, but you get used to it. You don't care anymore. It's just like I was telling you the other day about being on camera where it's like everyone hates watching themselves on camera.
Oh, I hate it.
You don't get over it.
No.
You know, if I watch this episode, I'll probably be like, you idiot.
Yeah,
you
know, no.
You look so dumb. But you just don't.
No, I got you.
No one cares.
But how did you get an interest in magic tricks?
My brother learned from an exchange student at our school.
That's how.
Yeah. And then I would help him with tricks.
Yeah.
Because, like, you know, it helps in certain tricks to have, like, an assistant to, like, plant a card here. Or I don't want to do too many secrets, but plant a card here to hide a card here. And so I, like, knew how all the tricks work. And then I was at a basketball camp, and this is such a funny story, actually. I was at a basketball camp, and my phone broke. So I had nothing to do. You know, when you don't have your phone, it sucks. I'm at this basketball camp, and some of my teams were playing poker. And, like, no one knew about the magic stuff. So I just started cheating at poker for fun because I know how to. I couldn't cheat at poker in a casino, but when you're playing with buds, I can definitely cheat pretty easily.
Yeah.
But we were playing with, like, a few dollars, and I told him at the end, I was like, hey, check it out.
Yeah, you want to get you want to get him.
I showed him. It's like, it's no fun if you don't know that I cheated the whole time.
Yeah.
So I showed that, and they're like, what? How'd you do that? I started showing them some magic tricks, and the basketball camp was in the summer. And then when I came back to school, like, you know, a month later, everyone was like, Chandler's a magician. And I was like, huh?
Yeah.
Oh, because I did magic tricks a few times at that camp. And then, like, someone would ask me to see a trick, and I'd show them, and it kind of just, like, snowballed from there. Like, I didn't even make the decision to do it myself. I just, people kept asking me to see one, and I knew them. And then you want to learn more because people keep asking you. You want to get better at something. And then when I went to college, I got sick really bad again because, like I said, I was always struggling with my stomach stuff, and I had to drop out of college, too. So I dropped out of college like I did of high school and missed a whole semester. And in that semester is when I started the YouTube channel, and I started posting all our stuff on there. And since it was tutorials and performances, first off, when we posted a performance video of, like, me and my brother walking around Philadelphia showing people magic tricks, I would go on Instagram and DM, like, by hand, thousands of people, like, watch my video, people I didn't know.
That's so, like, cold calling.
Yeah, kind of. Cold call people to watch my YouTube videos, and got, like, a few thousand views during that. And then, like, the algorithms weren't the same. There was no endless scrolling. Right. So if you're interested in learning magic tricks, you, Mitchell Brown, and we're talking about it in front of our phones because we live in a dystopian society that, like, in 15 minutes, if you start scrolling on Instagram, you're going to see magic tutorials.
After this, we
you.
Are.
Yeah, you will.
After this,
we you 100% are. Will, because they listen to what you're saying, listen to what you're typing, and it'll be there. And then some magician who's trying to grow his channel, you're going to know who he is, and you might watch and follow his videos now because the algorithm threw it at you because they want you to stay on the platform as long as possible. Oh. So back in my day, the walk was a lot.
Yeah.
You had to actually get after it, but those tutorials ended up taking off, and people would search for tutorials on how to do the magic tricks, and I think that's how we grew our channel mainly, and then I just kind of exploded from there.
At this point, it's a job.
Yeah, yeah.
YouTube is a job.
Yeah, I never made YouTube my full-time job, but in terms of money, it definitely could have been.
Yeah.
I didn't want to be a magician.
You didn't really have a super deep interest in it.
Yeah.
You were just kind of doing it because you knew how to do it.
Yeah, I was doing it and it was making money, so it was doing well and I didn't want to quit it. And I actually talked about this on a video I posted on my YouTube channel that, like, once I started filming with Joe and, like, made a documentary, I was like, it clicked for me. I was like, this is what I want to do.
Oh, wow.
This is it.
It was a light bulb moment.
Yeah, whereas, like, I really did enjoy YouTube, but they call it cardistry when you're good at manipulating cards and doing flourishes and stuff like that, and magic tricks was just a vehicle for me to film and edit stuff. It was just a subject.
Yeah.
And I quickly realized that, like, oh, I could do this for anything. It doesn't need to be cardistry or magic.
Really?
And that's kind of how I used YouTube to launch my filmmaking career.
Yeah. So you're learning about how to grow on YouTube through YouTube,
mm-hmm.
like by watching and all that.
Yeah.
And now
yeah.
you're growing, and then one thing leads to another. And
yeah. And then if I were to say the big difference, I for my job, I obviously do filmmaking.
Yep.
I've got a few documentaries I'm working on right now, but I also do, like, you know, business and client work. And the thing I always tell people is, like, nowadays you have it easy. Like, I helped a YouTube channel grow from like 0 to 15,000 subscribers this year. I helped one grow from 70,000 subscribers to 160,000 subscribers. It's kind of a tongue twister, say subscribers. But the methods are very easy, and it's like, you get really good short form content, like the vertical video scroll stoppers. Like, these apps will throw you new viewers.
Wow.
Like, they want to get you. Instagram, Facebook, YouTube, they want you to succeed. They want you to make content because they get money from all of
yeah.
them. They get people staying on their app. So
yeah, it's a symbiotic relationship.
If you're making good content, put it this way. This is how I summarize this current state of YouTube, Instagram, social media, is that the hidden talent does not exist anymore.
Wow.
It does not.
It's that simple.
Yes, yes. There's no diamond in the rough. Like, wow, I can't believe that person's not famous. If you're good at what you do and you're posting, you have to be good at what you do and be able to market yourself well. But if you, like, have good videos and good content, people will find you. That's how these algorithms are designed. There's no excuse of, like, man, no one's watching my stuff. If no one's watching your stuff, there's a reason.
It's probably because it's not interesting.
Yeah. That reason could be time.
Yeah.
You know, time could also be one of those reasons where it's like, all right, do it for another year. Right. But
a friend of mine in the YouTube industry now told me about just, like, about starting this podcast.
Yeah.
He's like, you're probably not going to get much traction at least in a year. I mean, I guess it's possible to get
right.
traction before that,
right.
but he said you need to give it a year.
But even with your short form content, I would probably say if you keep posting shorts and shorts and shorts and shorts and shorts, you know, you're not going to get someone who you don't know personally to be like, hey, listen to this 2-hour long podcast. You're probably not going to get that. But if they see a clip on Instagram and they're like, dang, oh, that Chandler Henry guy,
yeah,
he's an idiot. I want to hear more about his idiotic takes. They'll go watch the full episode.
Yeah, so the shorts are very important.
Yeah.
What are some other things?
Fishing line.
Yeah, no, it makes sense. What are some other things for maybe somebody aspiring to be successful on YouTube that are very important to the algorithm?
Your thumbnail and title are going to be the most important, but I think some people fall into clickbaiting too much,
mm-hmm.
and you'll end up shooting yourself in the foot.
Trash content.
If someone sees this epic thumbnail and title that's like, I shot a guy live on camera.
Yeah.
And you click on the video and no one's getting shot, man.
Yeah.
I'm clicking out.
Yeah, they're having a tea party or something. You're like, nah, this is trash.
You guys fooled me. And then how YouTube works with the algorithm, they don't reward videos that are clicked out of right away. They want to reward videos that are being watched almost all the way through.
Mm.
So if you can hold a viewer's attention, YouTube will push you and push you and push you. So you have to be honest about your titles and thumbnails, but like Mr. Beast says, like, you actually do need to have exciting content, you know?
Yeah.
Or not exciting, entertaining, appealing, you know?
You got to hold a viewer's attention.
Right. And where that's for a long podcast, there's obviously massively successful podcasts.
No, there are for sure. I noticed too, like already on just the little bit that I've posted, it seems like the median watch time on those videos is honestly low. But
yeah,
talking to my buddies, like I watched half of it on YouTube. I listened to half of it on Spotify.
It's like,
Thanks, bruh. You're like screwing it up. No. But you see what I'm saying though. It's like, I don't know, for the long form stuff, I think it has to be like very entertaining.
Right. Or informational.
Yeah.
Educational. So one of the things, like a couple of clients I work with that I tell them, I was like, if you ever have someone tell you that they know how the algorithm works and they know exactly how to get you famous on social media, you cannot trust them.
Yeah.
They are lying. First off, no one knows. But secondly, there is not a hard and fast way. There is not a direct way. Mr. Beast became the most watched YouTube channel on planet Earth by doing rapid, in-your-face, attention-retaining editing. Watching a Mr. Beast YouTube video, you'll blink and 5 minutes have passed because it's so in-your-face and fast. There's no breaths.
Really?
Yeah.
I haven't watched many of them at all.
It's very, very intense.
Wow.
But you know who Sam Solik is?
Yeah, that's
so he's a very famous bodybuilder.
Yeah.
He got famous by posting literally like 4 hour long uninterrupted vlogs, literally no editing. Like I start recording the camera. Here's me driving to the gym. Here's what I'm gonna do at the gym. Here is the uncut workout, me doing all my work, no editing, nothing. Upload 4 hour YouTube video. He has 6 million subscribers.
What?
Now. Yeah, and because people were wanting for that content of like feeling like your friend with the gym, you know, see, I want to see exactly what he's doing. I want to see exactly how long he's resting.
Yeah.
I want that raw feel. So people have gotten mega famous through multiple avenues. It's
more than one way to skin a cat.
Yeah. You don't need to be Mr. Beast.
Nah.
Hey guys, today I'm going to drive my car into a wall and see if I survive. Like there's other stuff other ways you can get famous.
Yeah.
Other ways you can get attention. Like one of my friends, Drew Darby, who's a filmmaker, he posts these like hour long feature length documentaries on YouTube about ultra marathon runners, multiples over 1 million views. That's not Mr. Beast style. It's very slow, very intentional, like movie based editing. There's a lot of different ways.
It boils down to quality content.
Right.
That's the most important thing.
Right.
With anything.
Exactly.
Quality content.
Yeah.
So through college though, at this point when you said that you really weren't that interested in maybe making this a full-time deal.
Yeah.
When did you decide to call it quits on YouTube?
I did YouTube. So that first documentary I made on Joe, it got me my first job and I was just, you know, I had a girlfriend, wasn't married. So I was just, I'm going to try and make as much money as possible, do my job and YouTube.
Mm-hmm.
And I even found ways to kind of like merge the two. Like there we are at these like sports athlete promotion parties and I'd be doing magic tricks there and make a YouTube video about it.
Wow.
Because my bosses knew I was good at magic.
Yeah.
And you're bringing all these MLB guys over to this mansion. They're like, hey, do some magic
tricks. Show me a trick.
And I'm like, I said, hey, this is exactly what I told him. I was like, if you want me to do magic tricks at the party, that's not in my job description. I'm not hired to be a magician. So you got to let me make a YouTube video about it. So it's a win-win. And they're like, sure. So I remember this is in Arizona. I called my friend over who lives in Arizona. I was like, yo, can you film me doing magic tricks at this party? He came over and we had a little viral video of me with all these MLB guys doing all these magic tricks.
Wow, that's really cool.
So I kind of merged them both together. And then I'll fast forward a couple years. YouTube was going well. We had some successful product launches. I was kind of doing it on my own at that point. My brother had stepped away to kind of like do his own thing.
Uh-huh.
And basically, Joe, remember this first documentary I made, he wasn't in the UFC yet.
Mm-hmm.
So without spoiling the documentary, some things that happened in his life when he tried to make the UFC, massive roadblock, and he was not going to make it to the UFC. He was going to have to retire because of a major injury he had. And then he kind of got a second chance at the UFC. And I was like, hold on, this is a Hollywood movie right now. This is a story right now. The documentary, the first one I made when I had no idea what I was doing, won second place in the country. So I've gotten a million times better since I made that in 2018. And Joe's story has like 5x'd in terms of like incredibleness about it. It just got that much more unbelievable.
Really?
So I deleted.
No, it's all good technical.
So I basically deleted the old documentary and was like, I'm going to remake this, but it's not anywhere near the same documentary.
Yeah.
We go over the same childhood stuff, but the path to the UFC is completely different now.
Really?
And it made it so much better. And I actually had a budget and real cameras. Well, I use some of the same cameras, but I just mean like real time to make it.
Yeah.
And dedicate my time to making it. Well, and when I knew I was going to take on that second documentary, the one that just came out, I was like, I can't do this on YouTube. I have to quit YouTube. Oh, so I made an announcement video. It's like, guys, I'm stepping away because I'm going to go live my dream. I'll see you later.
Wow. So you completely quit because you wanted to devote 100% of your time on the documentary.
Yeah, I don't think you can be a jack of all trades. What's the phrase? You can't be a jack of all. You'll be a jack of all trades master and of master none. Of none.
Yeah.
And I didn't want to be that. No, so,
being spread too thin, man. I feel that.
Yeah.
It's tough.
Yeah. No, there's a lot.
Something suffers.
I still want to do YouTube. I made a little comeback last year. I made like 4 or 5 videos on like different topics besides magic. And I still plan on coming back because I have 350,000 subscribers sitting there.
Still?
Yeah.
Do you really?
I think it's dropped under. I think it's like 343 right now.
The retention of the subscribers.
Yeah, I used to have over 360K, but you don't post for 2 years, people unsubscribe.
Absolutely.
And then coming back now, like I said, it's completely different now than when I started. Like, subscriptions used to really matter. And I think they still matter to a lot of people. Like, I got a couple of those plaques, the play buttons. Mm-hmm. But now it's all algorithm-based. You know, you could have 1,000 subscribers and pull 1 million views on a video. You could have 340,000 subscribers like me post a video and struggle to get 1,000 views.
Wow.
Because I'm going off genre, what I got famous, not famous, but what I got my viewers on, mm-hmm. Which was magic tricks. So I'm going off genre and I took a 2-year break.
You take it.
Those 340K are they're like, who's this?
Yeah, for sure.
You know, where have you been?
They got to kind of relearn you.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? Okay. So as you're making the documentary, though, do you quit to focus completely on it?
100%. Yeah.
And you dropped out of school at some point. Were you able to finish? Were you able to see through with your schooling?
No, I never.
What happened?
Yeah, I came back and I never graduated college. It looks like I did because I got pictures of me walking across stage.
Yeah.
But basically, you know, I went to Liberty University and, you know, from what I understand, I think it's a good school. I don't regret going there. You know, I didn't meet my wife there, but we definitely like basically got married there. Yeah. Like that's when we became
your relationship.
That's
there.
When we started dating. So I don't regret Liberty at all, but the digital media department really had it backwards with me, in my opinion, objectively looking back.
Of course.
Because one of the final requirements to graduate was an internship, right?
Mm.
And by definition, an internship is almost always unpaid. And if it is paid, it's very low. So at the time, yeah, I can't say specifics, but the YouTube channel was making a few $1,000s a month. Like it was pulling in more money than I could get on an internship. It was pulling in basically a full-time income. So I go and I'm like, hey guys, this is the digital media space. I have almost 100,000 subscribers. This is a legit business. I got products. I'm shipping stuff to people all over the world every day. I've got customers worldwide. I think I had like 25 million views already. And I'm like, this is digital media. Like I could, my company here, this YouTube channel, I could hire an intern to help me. That's how like big
busy you were. Yeah.
Yeah. And I'm like, can this just be my internship? The fact that I have this YouTube channel, and they were like, nope.
Mm.
And
doesn't make any sense though.
I kind of get it. But here's why I know their heart wasn't in the right place is because I was like, all right, whatever. We'll figure it. They let me walk because I was only 4 credits short and I was missing that internship. They let me walk across stage because they weren't going to hold me. They said, just get your internship during the summer. And I was like, okay. So that first documentary on Joe comes out. I release it on YouTube and it gets me my first job out of college at the sports agency immediately. And I'm immediately at the sports agency working with MLB guys, NFL guys, UFC guys, working championship fights, making high level documentaries for them, commercials. And I'm like, hey, I didn't get an internship, but I got a well-paying job in my field. Can that count as my internship? And they're like, no, it needs to be an internship. And I was like,
jeez,
isn't the point of a college degree to do exactly what I just did?
Absolutely. Without,
so you can't just see like if it was an unpaid internship, you would give me my credit so I can graduate. But since it's a paid job, the only reason you would ever do an unpaid internship is to get a job. So I skipped that step and I understand that's not an internship, but you can't.
Yeah, that doesn't make any sense.
You can't just make that apply. It really...
That is a shame.
The YouTube stuff, you know, I kind of get it, but I also don't. I'm still salty about that.
Yeah.
But the job part, I'm like, you guys are crooks. Yeah. I don't like that.
So the company that you went to work for, though, they weren't bothered at all that you...
Well, when you work in the media space or in the creative space, like if I went to Harvard and got a Harvard law degree or whatever... Harvard Digital Media, and you look at my documentary, it sucks.
Yeah.
And it's a bad documentary, and someone who doesn't have a college degree and makes a great one, all that matters is the final product. You know, when your job is creating a product, creating a thing, like if you're a home builder, you don't necessarily ask someone like, let me see your home building degree. You say, can I see some homes you've built? And if they look sick, build my house. It's the world is based on what you produce. So that's why, I mean, in the past, I've kind of been like ashamed or embarrassed of like, man, I never got my college degree. I should have finished that.
And don't I'm be
like,
ashamed at all over
I'm
that.
I'm like, all right, well, go look at my IMDb. Go look at my film festival awards. Like, I'm good at what I do. I know that. I've still got a long way to go. Of course.
Everybody does.
Yeah. Right? I don't have a big head of like, oh, I've made it now, but I didn't need your degree. And no. I even had a teacher ask me to like come speak and talk about my path because, you know, some of my stuff is on like Roku and Daily Wire.
Yeah.
And I was like, you want me to come talk to your class about my success in your field and you guys didn't give me a degree? That doesn't make any sense to me. It made me mad.
You should go. You should go and be like, hey,
none
kids,
of you need to be here. Go watch it on YouTube.
None of you need to be here. You should be attending YouTube University.
Yeah, you should. Yeah, because, dude, my YouTube stuff, I learned everything on YouTube when I was 16, 17, 8 years old. Yeah. Everything. All YouTube tutorials. There's some fantastic ones. And I even thought when I was in college, maybe I shouldn't make my degree anything video-based because I already know it. Wow. Now, people are going to say like, well, Chandler, you know, you think you know everything about video editing? That you learn in college, yes. That you learn, you only learn the basics in college. And there's a lot of stuff that isn't book stuff, right? Like you can know how to technically use an editing program, but you learning storytelling and pacing and timing is kind of like.
It's a gift. It's kind of innate, dude. Like some of that
you
stuff.
You know or you don't.
Yeah, it's
you
like,
can teach it, but sometimes when it comes to like picking music and picking, you know, where you want this moment to be.
Do you see it before you make it?
Yes.
How do you see it before you make it? What is your like creative way?
In my head,
Do you listen to music and see it?
I love music. Yeah. I'll almost make a scene purely based off a song I find.
Wow.
I have my Spotify. If like someone took my Spotify from me, I would.
You'd lose it.
That's like, I'm like, that's 15 years of work on my Spotify. Yeah. I got playlists for everything. I got everything.
Yeah, I love music too.
Yeah, it's the best way to pull emotion out of somebody.
Like listening to a song, you can think of a subject and you kind of like see it in real time over it.
Yeah,
so
exactly.
That's one way that you do it.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Yeah, no, I'm not saying it can't be learned.
Right.
But I feel like some people are just better at it than others.
Right. Right. So like, no spoilers, but Joe's obviously in the UFC.
Yeah.
So the documentary is called Journey to the UFC.
He made it.
It's not like, he made it. Yeah, he made it. He's doing well. So he obviously makes it to the UFC, but like when he made it to the UFC in real life, like I didn't have the documentary done yet, but I was just like, oh, I just need to make it now. Cause I know exactly what's going to happen. I know exactly how long it's going to be, what scene's going to be where, what music's going to go where. I just had to put in the work and make it.
Okay. So yeah, he makes it at this point. And then now you go back from what you had made. Did you reuse a lot of that? Or no, you completely redid it.
It's a completely different plot and structure.
Wow.
But I had some stuff like most fighters like Joe, they don't have that home video that I talked about.
Yeah.
But they also don't have someone following them around for the past decade. So I had tons of behind the scenes stuff. So like Joe and Sam are talking about him crying before a fight one time. Like I actually have that on film.
Wow.
It's only from like 5 years ago and it's like high quality footage. So I was able to like basically what I view it as is like I finished my first documentary.
Yep.
Like I was able to take it. What happens in the first documentary that I made in 2018 is like the first 12 minutes of the new documentary. You know?
Really?
Yeah.
Only really the first 12 minutes of it.
Yeah.
You shortened it up and then just extended the rest of it.
Yeah. Well, I extended the two different parts about his injury and his childhood. I extended those parts and kind of interwove them into his fights and how he's progressing.
So what kind of equipment did you need to get to make the new one? When you're like, all right, I'm going to take this on. I'm going to quit YouTube and I'm going to focus primarily on this.
Yeah.
What did you have to buy and where did you have to go?
I already had the cameras because my job through my sports agency that I was working for.
Okay.
And they were a Sony A7S3, a Sony FX3, a Sony FX6, like all the kind of cinema grade cameras.
Yeah, they're the higher end.
Aside from like, you know, the stuff that they're actually using on, you know.
Like a Hollywood movie.
Like Fast and Furious, they're obviously not using a Sony FX3. But what's funny is that some movie studios do use those cameras. Like, so the Batman, the new one with Matt Reeves directing it, the one that came out with Robert Pattinson a few years ago, a lot of that is shot on the same Sony cameras that I used to make my documentary.
Wow.
So they're really, really good cameras. And, you know, a lot of what makes a great camera is just the lens you have on it. You know, the camera body doesn't matter too much mm-hmm. as long as it can do the right color and bit depth. But so much of it is just lighting and color and pacing that makes it have that professional feel.
Wow. No way. I was going to say something about those cameras, but the editing software and stuff like, that's what I was going to ask you, is the mics. How did you get all the mic? Because, dude, it's like completely seamless. How is the audio so good? Are they mic'd up? Is there a boom? Like, how
both.
Did you?
Oh, both. I always run three audio just to be safe. So I run the camera scratch audio. They call it scratch audio when you're using the that. And then I have a microphone like this, but obviously in a film you hide the microphone.
Yep.
So not the same, but it's like a boom mic, I guess. And I would have it. I didn't mount it high because I wanted the space. So I would do it like right here, like looking up at them right here. And then I would clip a mic onto them underneath their shirt too. So I'd have three sources. And
wow.
In some cases that helps if you want room noise or if something just, I was doing it all myself. So I wanted backups in case something went wrong.
Dude, for sure. Yeah. And then now when you go into your editing software, you're going to pick and choose.
Oh yeah. My interviews with each guy in that documentary are all like 4 hours long, you know? So that's a lot of the work is finding the right spot, you know? And it's nice to be able to interweave stories. So like when Joe's talking about how his wrestling coach took him in, like he'll be like, yeah, and he would make me sandwiches when I was hungry, and it cuts to him be like, my wife would make him sandwiches. Like, you have to hear it from multiple angles.
No, it was very professionally
Thank you.
Done and well done. How was the learning curve on the software? You use Premiere Pro or no?
Yeah. I mean, I to this day, I've learned that I still do things differently than like for other professional editors because I'm self-taught. So like you learn something as you need it. So like I'm making a magic tutorial back in, you know, 2017. I'm like, man, I wish I knew how to animate a title like that. So I'll go and learn how to animate that title. And then, oh man, there was a car driving by. How do I take that out? You go look it up. So it's very spotty, right? Yeah. And now I think I pretty much know Premiere Pro backwards and forwards at this point, mm-hmm. but I'm sure there's stuff I don't know how to do. It's a very in-depth program.
Dude, that's what I was going to say, though, is I don't think people realize how in-depth it is until they actually open it up and try to do something. So something as basic as this, it's literally just video, audio, that's it. And it's just linear, right? Yeah. There's essentially no editing. So it's just linear. It is so complicated. Then you like look at these videos where, so I'm like trying to like sync up audio. It's not syncing up. I feel like a boomer. I feel like a complete idiot. I'm like, dude, I can't hardly get the audio to sync up. And he's like making a full length documentary.
Should see, if you're at a corner of my house, I'll show you the timeline.
I would love to see that.
It's disgusting.
Looks like a checkerboard.
Yeah. My one friend who's also a director, he was looking at my timeline because I was like, hey, you know, I'm about to submit this, the final draft. Can you come over to my house and like give a once over from a different set of eyes? Because I'm the only one who's looked at this. And he looked at him and was like, wow, this is a very creative assembly you have.
Yeah.
I'm like, hey, it works, man.
No, it works.
It works. So I'm not the most organized guy. There's people who are really organized about it, but
you made it work.
Works for me. And you know, there's this phrase that I learned that I really like live by when it comes to just work stuff. And it comes to the intimidation from working on bigger projects. You know, this could work for any career where it's like, if you know how to swim in a 6 foot deep pool, you can swim in the ocean. As long as you have the skill set, it doesn't matter how big or small the project is, right? So at this point, I had made the first documentary on Joe, which was an hour long. And then I had made all these sort of mini documentaries that were like 12, 20, 40 minutes long. And, you know, I'm not scared about making a bigger project because you just do the same process and repeat one scene at a time. So like when you look at the timeline, it looks like this monstrosity.
Absolutely.
It's like, well, that took me 4 months to make. So it would look like that, but you're always zoomed in doing the tiny edits. Like if you know how to build a small house, you should know how to build a big house. It's just bigger pieces.
Bigger pieces, yeah, just more time.
Exactly.
More time. How much time did it take you from start to finish? On the documentary.
A lot less than I think it would have if I didn't know Joe's story so well.
Oh.
So I did it all in 4 months, which is kind of unheard of. But
from the beginning of filming to the ending of editing.
Yeah. But that was because I had that first documentary. I got to skip so much of the stuff you'd have to do in a normal documentary because I was like, once Joe got his knockout in his UFC debut, I was like, all right, well, that's end scene. And now we just got to get there.
Yeah.
You know?
For sure.
Like I remember in Joe's debut fight, Daniel Cormier said like, man, people say there's no pressure for Joe, but I think there's all the pressure in the world. He just got this big chance in the UFC. He cannot fall flat on his face. And I was like, well, that's how in the documentary, like I made that decision when I heard it live.
Yeah.
Right. So it's like a lot of the story was assembled in my head, and it was just the man hours of sitting down for like 6 or 8 hours a day and doing it and doing it and doing it. And I'm a horrible sleeper. I always want to work on stuff at night. I'll have a thought in bed and get up and do it. Huh. And it was really bad when I was making that film, because I think some days I was doing like 15 hours of editing on that documentary to get it done. Because the main thing I was worried about was I want it to come out before Joe's next fight.
Oh.
You know, because not only people would say, well, you think he's going to lose that way on it to come out? No, because the story changes.
Yep.
With every fight, the story changes. What if Joe gets another 5-second knockout? Well, then if that's not in the documentary, that sucks.
Yeah.
You know, so I just wanted to get it out before his career really advanced too far, because it's called Journey to the UFC. So we got to get it out as quickly as possible.
No, for sure. So when you were making it, though, that's what I was going to ask you, was about your like your work day.
Yeah.
You were just gung ho.
Yeah.
Dopamine was high. You were ready to get this thing done.
The difference between like, you know, now I work for myself. Back then I was working for somebody, but they gave me the freedom to work when I want. Cause it's like, listen, guys, this is not, you know, I love working with my hands in real life. Like I love building things outside of video editing. I love working on my house. I've been renovating my house. But like when it comes to installing flooring, you do one piece and the next piece, you know, it's a process and it's kind of fun besides your back breaking. But it's kind of fun where it's like, you know what the next step is to do. You never get stuck.
Yeah.
When you're editing, sometimes you sit there and you're like, I have no idea how I'm going to connect this point to that point. I got to take a step back. I got to think about this.
Yeah.
You know, like, how do I get from this scene? Okay, so Joe just broke his arm. How do I get to this next scene where we're talking with the doctor? How do we get there? And that's not an answer that you're just going to just sit there and think and think and think and think. And now if I think hard enough, it'll come to me. You kind of have to wait.
And you kind of have to walk away.
Yeah, yeah.
You have to walk away.
Later. And lots of times I would come and, you know, you can zoom in and out in your timeline when you're editing. I've been like, okay, zoom out. I don't want to mess with that area anymore. I'm frustrated.
Yeah.
Go back and do something else. There's, you know, an hour-long film. And originally when I have it on the timeline, it was probably a five-hour-long film that I had to whittle down.
Did you get to the end of it and you're just like, you watch it back, you're like, oh, I just don't like this part. And you have to go back.
Yes, and that's something that I don't think I'll ever go away. Like there's still things I wish I could change about it, but
that was my next question.
At the same time, not really.
Yeah. Like it is what it is.
When I sit down and watch, like I've been forced, since I finished it, I've been forced to watch it, I think like 6 times with people, whether it be at premieres, there's a couple of premieres, film festivals. And when I'm with other people, I can enjoy it and be like, ah, I did a good job on this.
Yeah.
But if I'm like looking at it myself, I'll be like, there'll be sometimes when I'm like impressed with myself, I'll be like, Ooh,
nice
one, Chandler. Yeah, that was perfect. And there are times I'm like, you should have done that, but it's nothing. It's never anything important. It's stuff that only I notice. You know?
Absolutely.
You know?
Yeah. No, dude, anything. Like, we're going to get done with this, and I'm going to watch it back. I'll be like, oh, I missed this question.
Yeah,
I missed that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, you only see it in retrospect.
Yeah.
But no,
I will say, though, a quote that I live by when it comes to creating something is a piece of art isn't finished when there's nothing that can be added. It's when nothing else can be taken away.
Oh.
You have to have it succinct, right? Like when you think there's nothing, like Joe's life story plays out in 72 minutes. I don't think I could get it any shorter. I know I could get it longer.
Yep.
Like if Netflix came to me and said, we love it, Joe, we need to be 3 hours, I'd be like, that's easy. I can make this thing longer.
For sure.
It's very easy to make something longer. Making it shorter, that's where it gets hard.
It's short, making it shorter and still
makes sense.
Yeah, makes sense and being meaningful.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, you can't cut out important stuff just for the sake of making it shorter.
And my goal was to make it short. And I guess 72 minutes is kind of short, but the reason why is because like now Joe's gotten more famous, but
for sure.
But 4 years ago, well, not 4 years ago, 2 years ago, he had just gotten into the UFC.
Mm-hmm.
He's not Conor McGregor.
Yep.
So like, you know, people are going to watch a Conor McGregor documentary no matter what.
Yeah.
I want someone to watch a Joe Piper documentary. They're probably not going to give me 4 hours at a time.
Yeah.
You know, now they will. Yeah, now they would. But that's because Joe's been killing people still.
Yeah, he's been killing people off. No, man, that's amazing. The whole complexity of how everything comes together. And like you said, that's a great way of describing it. It's, you know, putting together a floor. Step one, step two, step three. And then you do step one on your documentary and you're like, okay.
It's not a linear process.
It's not. You know, it's up and down and back and forward and the whole nine, which is crazy. I think anything creative, though, is.
Right.
You know, like anything, like, you know, building this or doing whatever, you're just like, I don't really know what the next step is.
Right.
But I guess for you, it sounds like it's just action, you know, like film stuff, listen to what they have to say, mm-hmm. and then watch it back and put it all together.
Yeah, there's always something you can be working on. That's actually a Conor McGregor quote. When he was injured, he was like, there's always something. You can always be working on something if you're injured or if you can't. There's always something you can be doing.
Yeah.
You know, I catch myself that a lot during the workday where I'm like, okay, well, this video is exporting. This one's downloading. I got nothing to do for the next 15 minutes. It's like, you could probably find something to do.
Yeah, absolutely.
There's something to work on. There's always something to work on.
So what's it been like now that the documentary is out and your experience with like traveling around and doing stuff with Joe?
It's been awesome, dude. It's been a blast because typically when I'm with Joe, it's always involving a fight, which just brings a ton of stress. Mm-hmm. Like I'll be going out to Vegas the end of this month, first week of October for his fight. He's on the Alex Pereira card, like I said, fighting on October 4th.
And it's a good card to be on.
I always spend a lot of time for Joe around his fight weeks. But it's stressful because you're like, man, my friend's fighting. You're like, you know, it's not fight to the death, but it's fight until the referee thinks, like, if the ref isn't there, it would be fight to the death. It's it's fight until you can't fight. They lock the door behind you. It's terrifying.
They're not playing around.
No. It's terrifying stuff, especially when, like, the guy Joe's fighting has a ton of knockouts.
You know? Does he actually?
Yeah, he's a ton. Joe has just as many. Like, you know,
is he a ground guy, this guy? Likes to get you on the ground? Grapple it up.
I don't know too much about him. You know, it's funny. When it comes to other UFC fights, I'll deep dive and try and like make my best pick. I literally, when Joe gets an opponent, I like won't look. I won't watch tape. I don't watch any. I don't want
to. You just wait for it to happen.
Yeah. There's nothing I can do.
No.
I can't give Joe fight advice. I don't know anything. I'll let his coaches handle that. Like, there's nothing I can say besides, Joe, man, I believe in you. I think God has a plan for your life. Let's hope it's like, you know, that you win.
You got this.
There's nothing I can do besides try and, you know, get Joe the biggest platform possible, get him as much views as possible, help him with sponsorships and stuff like that.
No, you're being a good friend.
Yeah, helping him out there. But it was fun. I was going to say, to your point, Daily Wire bought the documentary. Mm-hmm. Roku had already had it, but Daily Wire was non-exclusive, so Daily Wire got it too. And we got to go out to Nashville and do a lot of promotion with them. And it was like the first time in a long time where Joe and I got to like hang out for a week without the stress of a fight. And it was a blast, man. We got to sit front row and watch UFC like in the arena. They played the trailer on the big screen. Like for a packed crowd, it was really, really fun. So it's been a blast promoting the documentary. He's got to go on Joe Rogan to promote it, Sean Ryan to promote it.
Yep.
A ton of other podcasts, but those are the two big ones. Like Ben Shapiro, he went on that.
Oh, he did?
Yeah, to promote it.
Wow.
A lot of different ones.
I listened to Rogan's and I listened to Sean Ryan's.
Yeah.
What was it like going out there to do those?
Awesome.
I bet it was amazing.
Awesome. Both, you know, I am around a lot of famous people through my work, and they're not all nice people. There's been some pretty people who you're like, you know, oh my gosh, I do not want to work with this guy again. Like just divas, people who think to the center of the universe, people who don't treat you well, people who could care less about, you know, it's just, you deal with some stuff.
Yeah, for sure.
Joe Rogan and Sean Ryan are not those people. They're exactly what they seem like.
Wow.
You know? Joe, one of the things that and this isn't like something that is a big deal. I wouldn't say if someone doesn't do this, it's a bad thing. But when someone does do it, it stands out to me because whenever I'm with these famous people, I'm not the center of attention.
No.
Like, let's say it's not just Joe because I work with other people, but let's say Joe, like Joe Rogan is there to talk to Joe Pyfer. I am just Joe Pyfer's friend at that point. I am just the guy who made his documentary. So when we're standing there in the lobby, like the fact that Rogan will talk to Joe for a while and then turn to me and spend 20 minutes talking to me, I'm like, dude, talk to Joe.
Yeah.
You know? But if them not caring that you are not a famous person too, they treat you just normally. Like that is what always stands out to me of like, oh, you don't think you're better than anyone else. You're just a down-to-earth guy who just happened to become massive and you stayed true to yourself.
Yeah, that's the key. Mm-hmm. Just be yourself. Also shows, man, just their humility.
Right.
You know, to be able to talk to anybody and
right. Like Sean like Ryan that. Followed me on Instagram like after the show. I was like, dude, that's cool.
That's amazing.
That's awesome. Like, you didn't have to follow me. I'm just me. I just make documentaries, you know.
Oh, no doubt. I'm gonna get him on here one day.
Yeah, we'll get him on here.
Yeah, we'll get him on one day. I can't wait to talk to him.
Yeah.
No, that's amazing, dude. I listened to his Sean Ryan episode was nuts. And I really wanted to DM him. I still might, just to say, dude, like thank you for being so honest and transparent.
I can get a message to him.
We need to tell him that for sure. Yeah. So talk to me about your work going on right now. What do you got going on?
I can't really.
You can't go into too much of it.
No, I got two documentaries going on right now, but I'm not at the point where I can talk about either of them.
But the point of it is, though, is that you went into something, made a career of it, and now you are still in that industry.
Yeah, yeah. With hopefully projects growing coming up. Growing and growing, you know. I'll definitely be going overseas to film next year. That will be exciting.
Wow.
I could probably talk about that one, but I'll wait. It's just, when it comes to this stuff, I don't like talking about it until I have something to show.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I totally get that. Yeah, so, I totally get that.
I got two projects.
Cool.
They're both pretty exciting. It'll be fun. It'll be a fun next year and a half here.
Yeah, for sure. In the time, though, that you were making the documentary and you're like trying to dive into this career, what kind of support did you get from your family and from your wife? Were they saying, like, go ahead, pursue this career?
Yeah, absolutely.
This is
a cool
thing.
You know what my biggest pet peeves in life is? You can get on a tie right here. When people try and pull the no one believed in me card.
Yeah.
Listen.
They believed in you.
Yeah. For most people, unless you have like truly horrible parents, which some people do.
They do.
Some people have absolutely horrible parents, but when you see like a normal person who grew up in the suburbs like me and it's like, no one believed in me. It's like, no, actually probably everyone really wanted you to be successful.
Yeah.
You know, maybe my one dean at Liberty didn't want me to be successful because he hated my YouTube channel.
Take that.
You want me to come talk now? No, sir. But I would say that everyone else, like Joe, my parents, my wife, everyone, just
they were supporting me.
You know, and I think that's just, you know, if any friend wants to pursue something, you know, like I I've never really dealt with any hate or lack of support.
Yeah.
You know, you get hate comments on YouTube for sure. I've gotten a ton of hate comments on YouTube, but like,
that's part of it.
I don't really care if I don't know who you are. From people who you know, maybe there's someone behind the scenes. Like, for example, maybe there's someone behind the scenes when I post a new YouTube video or Instagram reel. It doesn't get that many views. You're like, oh, look at Chandler over here.
Yeah.
Almost 30, making a YouTube video. I'm like, well, if they don't say it to my face, I don't care.
For sure.
You know, like, you might have people who you know who are like, why is he doing this podcast? But like,
I'm sure there's a bunch.
Who cares?
Yeah.
Who cares? Anyone, the phrase about there's no one who's doing better than you who will hate on you is like 100% true.
Yep.
Like, I built a YouTube channel from scratch. I know exactly how it feels like to have no one watching. Like, I would never discourage anyone from doing it. It's always the people who are too scared to try something who would be like, they see you trying something.
They talk
and
smack.
Going for something bigger than like, they see you and they're not jealous of success. They're jealous of your like,
you got
will
guts
or
to
confidence
do it.
To try it because they're too scared
to.
Yeah. Right. And you know,
you got guts to try.
In my case, like, I've had some early success and, you know, hopefully it continues.
No, it will. But, I know it will.
But, like, I'm not worried about what people think. No. I am sometimes. Like, I think that people lie when they say that. Like, of course you're worried a little bit about what people think, but I'm able to turn that off most of the time and just be like, if someone's going to be my friend, then I'm going to assume they're supporting me. And if any of my friends are doing something that they want to be better at, I'll support them, and that's just how it works.
No, it's encouraging, though, to see somebody doing better than you because you're like, he's doing it.
Right.
Like, this is attainable.
Right.
Like,
and right now, like, there are moments where I, you know, feel like, oh man, I should be further along. And I'm like, dude, if you talked to yourself 2 years ago, he would be hype for you. You're
for
exactly
sure
where you need to be. And you do everyone. Once you get to where you want to go, there's something new, you know?
Yeah.
So my big thing was to get something on TV. Now I'm like, oh, I want another one on TV. Or it's like, well, Chandler, you got one on TV, man.
Yeah.
It's on a lot of TV channels. Like,
for sure, dude. If you if you showed whatever year it was that you started doing the documentary, you showed
just
that
showing
version.
IMDb page. I was like, I have an IMDb.
Yeah,
what the
dude.
Heck?
You show that's, him that now?
Yeah.
Bro.
There's always steps to it.
Yeah, you feel like this is going to be
there's
sick.
There's always steps. And just with you, too. Like, I would be willing to guarantee you that if you stuck with this for a year and posted all your shorts, that you'd have multiple viral shorts.
Hopefully
now,
we do.
You know, and that's literally, I think, you know who Alex Hormozi is?
Yeah.
He has this quote where he says, volume negates luck.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, all right, if you posted 1,000 shorts and only 3 went viral, well, that, you know, you had 997 that didn't. But, like, you still probably generated, like, 5 million views. Like, that's freaking amazing.
And I don't want to do it for the sake of being viral. I just want to put, like, we were talking about putting out quality content. Like, hopefully somebody listens to this and then they think, No, I'm interested in what Chandler has done for a living. I want to do that too.
This probably relates to what you're saying is I'm really interested in staying power. And what I mean by that is this podcast, I could watch it 10 years from now and be like, wow, like it would be valuable to me. And maybe it's valuable to someone else 10 years from now. But like when it comes to kind of like the throwaway short form content that's really popular now.
Yeah.
I'm not talking about shorts for like podcasts, but just like Vine stuff where it's like, I probably watched 100 Instagram reels yesterday, unfortunately. I couldn't name one of them because they're entertaining in the moment. I was like, ha, 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 brain
it
rot.
It doesn't retain you.
Yeah, but
you don't retain
hopefully it. My documentary in 10 years, someone could watch and it would still be powerful to them.
It will be.
You know?
I know it will be.
So when it comes to a long-form podcast like this, when it comes to stuff like my goal is just that it's something that someone could learn something from and that doesn't age out right away.
No, I know it's not going to age out right away. I mean, you're following your dream. Technically don't have a college degree and you're ripping it. Like you're doing it.
Yeah.
You know,
it's been fun.
Yeah. It's not the most important thing to go to school. Cause there's so many people that are in that transition where they're like, okay, I need to go to college. I need to figure out what I want to do with my life. And like, this degree is going to solve everything.
Yeah.
And it doesn't.
Yeah.
Doesn't.
Oh, there's very few jobs. There are jobs that you need a college degree, and I completely understand that.
Yeah.
Like you want to be a doctor or a lawyer, or there's a few other ones, like obviously nursing, but like almost any job besides, I'm missing some. Someone might be.
Yeah, no doubt. They're going to be like, oh, this job.
But like, you know, even like selling at a bank, like, all right, let me train this job for 2 weeks, and I bet you I could do it because I can learn things, you know?
Anybody can learn anything they put their mind to.
And like, I'm not a professional plumber or an electrician or whatever, but I've done all the work in my house because I don't think I'm dumb. I believe that I can learn things. So if I can't figure out how to install this sink, let me watch a couple of YouTube videos and I'll figure it out.
Yep. For sure.
You got to believe in your ability to learn things.
You do have to believe in your ability to learn things.
You don't have to just have one thing you do.
No, yeah. For sure. Being diversified is a good thing.
Yeah.
And, you know, learning a bunch of things.
And you know what? This is off topic, but learning is good also if you don't get scammed.
Yeah.
Like if someone's coming doing electrical on your house, you should know a little bit about what they're doing so they
for
can't
sure.
pull something on you.
Yeah.
Because that happens.
No, I'm sure.
I've dealt with it.
No, I'm sure. But when you were making that documentary, it was just you were doing it out of the love of trying to pursue your dream. And you weren't really worried about
where
it was
going to take
you.
Originally, I was just doing it to help a friend. That was the original process. There was no thought of money. I did not think I was going to stop YouTube. I did not think I wanted to be a documentary filmmaker or a filmmaker in general. The literal original thought was, man, that knockout was sick. I wish it could have been better. Like, I wish it could have been seen better. I wish it could have been marketed better. I just wanted to help him grow his platform. And
that led to all that.
Right. Led to all of that. I was just trying to help.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
It's crazy how that stuff happens, where it leads from one thing to another.
Yeah.
So what do you say to somebody who is, I got two questions. The first is, what does a day in the life of a, like, you're not, or I guess you're technically freelance, right? Freelance.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm freelance filmmaker.
Contractor, filmmaker, yeah.
What does it sometimes look like?
Well, it could be wake up at 5 a.m. and follow a UFC fight around till 2 a.m. and get 2 hours of sleep and barely eat food. Or it could be nothing.
Like, yep.
It all depends if I'm in production or not. One of my documentaries right now is like halfway through being filmed and the other one's in pre-production. I won't start filming till like January, February.
Okay.
And pre-production's a lot of not fun work, like budgets and...
Oh, is it actually?
Yeah. It's like actual business stuff, which is the least favorite part of trying to figure that stuff out. That part sucks.
You didn't really have to do a whole lot of that with yours, or you did?
I did, yeah. There was a lot of that stuff behind the scenes.
Dude.
A lot of paperwork, a lot of divvying up of stuff, a lot of... It's never fun. It's just... It's not what you... Like, you know, it's like, you know, I basically have an agent now. I have to, like, to deal with this stuff because you can't get screwed over. You can't... You got to have someone watching your back. And once you get to the point where you're doing, like... bigger numbers, you have to have someone watching out for you. You know,
for sure.
That's advice I would give to an early filmmaker is you have to be very aware of that stuff early on. Because
advocating for yourself.
That industry, there's going to be people who do not have your best interests at heart who are going to try and screw you over, and you have to be ready for it. Just like plumbing.
Yeah.
You know, just like plumbing or electrical. You gotta know your stuff and have someone there to help you if you
need
it.
For sure.
You know?
What about someone who is looking to get into the industry and maybe do some freelance stuff for their own? What are some recommendations about here's some gear that you need, and here's kind of how you do it and put this stuff together and market yourself. How do you do that?
So kind of like what I was saying about YouTube, how there's never been an easier time to be a YouTuber.
Mm-hmm.
Listen, my cameras I have now are pretty expensive, but the cameras that you're using this podcast on, like, that's what I made my first documentary on. And almost all of that B-roll footage is in the new documentary that's on TV. Uh-huh. A ton of places.
Off of these.
Off of those. Same exact camera. Same exact one. So, like, if you want to prove yourself as a filmmaker or a documentary maker, and the barrier to entry is, like, $800. Now, I understand that's a lot of money. I'm not discounting $800, but, like, in the past, it was, like, you need a film crew and 80K minimum. So it's like, okay, save a couple of paychecks, put some money away, get a camera. And I would even say, our phone cameras are good enough. If you want to show what you can do storytelling wise, like, you give my $15,000 camera setup to someone and say, hey, go make a video about the sea turtles coming out on the beach at night. But they have to verse me and I'm using my phone. I'm going to make a better product than that.
Yeah.
Because it's not about the quality of the footage if you don't know how to use it. Yeah. It's about storytelling and stuff like that. So the barrier to entry, if you want to make a great documentary, is use your phone and go interview some people, get some music, and edit some stuff together. Like,
it's that simple.
Yeah. There's no excuse if you want to do it and can't. There's no money excuse. It's just time and putting the effort into it.
For sure. Yeah. And and just being able to tap into how you can see that finished product.
Right.
That's something to really practice too, probably.
For sure. For sure. You have to know what you want to make before you make it.
Yeah.
You
know? And kind of see it before you make it.
Yeah.
In a way.
You have a plan.
Mentally.
Yeah. Now with Joe, there was a little bit of gambling there because, you know, I put all this work into this film and he had to make the UFC. Like, yeah. I was pretty much done the film and he had to make it the UFC and win his first fight. And I remember sitting there, I'd filmed him getting his hand wraps, and I got some of the best footage of my life of Joe getting his hand wraps by the famous Tate, the cut man Tate from the UFC.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Joe looks like he's about to, like, you know, put a hole in the wall while he's getting his hand wraps. And I'm sitting there, and I can film all in the locker rooms, but I'm not allowed to film in the arena because it's pay-per-view.
Okay.
So I'm in the UFC's break room, okay, and I filmed it. I filmed with myself watching the fight on the TV. The fight's happening 30 feet from me in the UFC arena, and I'm in their break room watching the live stream on TV alone. And I'm just thinking, like, wow, I just spent, like, you know, 8 years on this. Let's win the fight. Like, you know, if he loses, this is kind of all in smoke.
Dude.
And he won by first round knockout. And it's funny, I have a video. It was like one of those plastic tables in the UFC break room. I basically broke it in half. Like, I didn't break it. But, like, on the video, I don't even know what got into me when I watched back the video. He knocks him out. I go, and I, like, double fist Hulk smash the center of the steel. Like, bang. And I start, like, screaming. And, like, UFC, one of the UFC, is like, everything okay? And I was like, yeah.
Dude, everything's great,
everything's
bro.
Fine, man. Just got an 8-year gamble paid off. We're good.
Dude, that's crazy. So you were literally watching it on...
Oh, so yeah.
That knockout, you're watching it in the break room. Like,
knowing that, like, okay, this is going to be the credits rolling if, like, he gets this knockout. Like, I didn't only want to win. I wanted a knockout.
Yeah, you
win,
wanted so you to smoke him.
Cut the credits on the knockout. That's what I wanted to do for years. I'm like, I'm going to cut the credits on a knockout. I'm going to cut the credits on a knockout. And he did it. And it was it was perfect. It was perfect. So he knocks him out, and the ref has to pull you off. So he knocks him out. The guy falls backwards and is, like, still a little bit there. And then Joe looks at him and screams at him. And then there's one follow-up punch.
Oh, my gosh.
And then he pulls him out. So he knocks him out, cuts to credits. Then it uncuts to credits, show the follow-up punch. And then it cuts to credits again.
Oh, my
gosh. And I was like, yes, this
is
perfect.
Yeah, that's amazing. Dude, that's amazing. It worked out perfectly.
Yeah.
It worked out perfectly. How did you know the coach, his coach, that was like his father figure, just from school?
Yeah, he was a teacher at our same school.
Wow.
Yeah.
So it was easy to get a hold of him, though.
Everyone. Yeah, it was like my whole network was the perfect setup because, like, typically you need a producer for stuff like that, but I was able to do everything myself and schedule interviews because I knew everyone. The hardest interview to get for the documentary was a doctor.
Oh, but, it was?
Yeah, just because, like, who am I at that point?
Yep.
And he's a very well-known, well-respected surgeon, one of the best on the East Coast. He, like, you know, does surgeries on guys on the Phillies and the Eagles, you know, all the local
big name
guys, Sixers. And he did Joe's surgery. And I was like, hey, man, I got to talk to you. And Joe was the one who was like, yeah, I got his number. Oh. And I remember going into his office with like my cameras, and I think he was expecting a film crew, and it was just me. And I was like, trust me. And then, you know, fast forward a year later, he's at this big red carpet film festival with like signing his name on a poster. I'm like, hey, I told you.
Yeah.
I told you.
Yeah.
Now, at the time, did I really believe that? Probably not. But
yeah, no, he got to go.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
He got to go. How hard was it to get all your B-roll and stuff for that? Like the aerial stuff.
Oh, that's just having a drone.
Really? Yeah. Just fly it up.
Yeah. Rest in peace, that drone. That's a whole other story. I was filming with this NFL guy in Nashville earlier in the year.
Uh-huh.
And there's this construction company I do work for, and they built this amazing, beautiful mansion in Nashville. It's like 16,000 square foot barn dominium. And I work with this company called 1845 Barn Dominium. It's making their like, YouTube content. And this, I'm flying my drone over this house, and it literally looks like it got shot out of the air. Boom. Like, almost looks like it looks like it physically got hit by something.
Wow.
Turns upside down and bam into the center of this brand new house and like explodes on the roof. It hit so hard. And these people, it was my first time working with them. I was like, that's not my fault. I was like, that, I don't know what happened. And the owner of the company went and like got on the roof of this brand new home. Thankfully it didn't dent the house.
No doubt.
And I was like, give me that SD card. Cause they thought I hit something. I was like, I didn't hit anything. So they put the SD card in, and I'm watching with, it was Delaney Walker. You can find the video on YouTube. It got over 1 million views. It was awesome.
Dude.
We did like an MTV Cribs style thing of the house. It's a beautiful home. I basically made a mini documentary on it. Wow. So I take this SD card, I put it in my laptop, and I was like, there's my evidence. And the drone's just flying and shuts off.
What do you think? It just had
Delaney told me that there's a lot of houses around him of like people who are very like, what's the word?
Like preppers?
Yeah.
Kind of?
He's a single jammer.
Oh, really?
Someone signal-jammed my drone and shot it out of the sky.
Shot it out of the sky.
Turning it off, yeah. They turned it off on me.
Oh, my gosh. It was like a higher quality drone?
Lost a few $1,000 that
day. Oh, my gosh. That's not good.
It was rough.
Yeah.
So I'm drone this right now. I'm like, I'll buy a new drone whenever I need to use a drone.
Yes.
Until then. I'm gonna, it's like shattered into pieces. It's like still at my house. I'm gonna like make like a frame, like a shadow box
in memoriam,
and like kind of display it cool, like shattered, and cool. Be like, "RIP DJI Mavic yeah. Pro 2, 2018 to 2024."
That's crazy.
25, yeah.
What is it like? So you weren't front row on that UFC fight on his comeback, but what is it like being front row or close to front row? Is it nuts?
Yeah, it's nuts. It's nuts. Because that was my first time. People like saw all my... Because I had a ton of UFC fights, a ton mm-hmm. of UFC experience. But because it's pay-per-view, they're not going to let me and my camera in the arena. Mm-hmm. So like I've been to a lot of championship fights. And, you know, you're in the locker room. Your friend or whoever you're working with walks out. And then you're watching on the TV in the locker room. And at T-Mobile Arena where you're at, you can hear like the stadium rumble. And there's like a TV delay. Right. So you'll hear like the reactions and you're like, oh no, what just happened? So like when Joe got his knockout that I'm talking about, when I was screaming and punching the table, I heard like commotion. I knew something had happened in the fight. And then 2 seconds later, I see boom.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. It was like a little lag.
So you knew something was going on.
Yeah. So like now that was at the Apex, which doesn't seat that many people.
Mm-hmm.
But like for T-Mobile Arena, when there's like 20,000 people there, and Bruce Buffer's yelling, it's time. I'm in the locker room, like your chest is shaking. And when someone gets knocked out, you feel it before you see it. So that's a really interesting experience. But being front row, which I was able to do for UFC Nashville with the Daily Wire.
It's crazy.
It's cool. It's
10 really out of 10 cool. would recommend.
Yeah. Yeah. Derek Lewis got a first round knockout when I was there. And it was wild. They rumble.
Yeah. I'm sure it's way better than watching it on TV.
Yeah. It's an experience. It also, what it does is it really humanizes it too.
Yeah.
Because on the TV, like someone gets knocked out, they cut away and show the replay a few times. When you're there in person, you see the person like trying to get up, trying to come to, being carted off, being stretchered off, being limping off, you know.
It's intense.
It really humanizes it where it's like, oh shoot, these guys are actually, they're not TV characters.
It's very intense.
Yeah.
Who were the other guys that were fighting on that one? Do you remember who they
Which
were?
Which one? For Nashville?
Yeah, the one you went and you were close to front row.
Wonderboy fought. Mm. I got to sit with Michael Chandler. He was watching front row with us.
He seems so legit.
He was legit. He was very legit.
He has a really good cool mindset, guy. Man. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I hope he can get some wins here soon because he's one of my favorite fighters.
Me too.
I love everything about him. But, you know, when you're fighting the best of the best, like, you know, what are you going to do? Clown Michael Chandler for losing a few fights in a row to the best in the world?
Yeah,
it's like
for real.
When you're fighting the best in the world, you know, anyone can win.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I always root for him.
Yeah, that's why it's so impressive in the UFC when someone is the champion for so long, because it's like, you know, this isn't like best fighter in the state. This isn't the world.
No.
You know, to hold off, and there's always an element of, I wouldn't say luck to fighting,
mm-hmm.
but like, you know, lots of the UFC fighters, I'm going off the opinions I've heard of UFC fighters, because I'm not a UFC fighter, where mm-hmm. they say like, it's much more impressive sometimes for someone to have like a 25-minute decision where they dominated someone for 25 minutes straight than like a first round knockout, because sometimes an incredibly talented fighter can just get caught. Mm-hmm. You can make one mistake and you can get caught. To have 25 minutes of no mistakes and just mauling somebody,
that's super impressive.
Yeah.
Super impressive.
But sometimes when you're like, Joe, you're just that much better that it's time to
yeah.
finish this one early.
No, absolutely, man. So that's exciting. You're getting ready to go out.
Yeah.
Out west.
Yeah.
When do you leave for that?
The fight's October 4th, so probably like September 29th.
Oh, wow.
28th, yeah.
Go out there. Are you going to do some content for him?
Yeah, I always do. He's got a lot of Fight Week sponsors, so help activate those sponsors and help nice. Him out. And then I'm always filming just in general in case, you know, I believe he'll be a UFC champion. So when that documentary comes out, I got to have the most content possible.
Yeah, yeah. And so, but after your documentary comes out and you're doing your thing, now doors did start to open for you for this guy. He wants you to film, and now this company wants
yeah,
you to film.
Yeah, for sure.
It happened pretty quick.
A couple of them I had already set up before the documentary came out.
Okay.
Like the documentary took a while to come out.
Mm-hmm.
So I would like send it to people in the industry like before it came out. I'd be like, hey, this is coming out, but I got to schedule something new here. So my guy in Australia, I'll say Australia. My Australia thing might be happening soon. So
yeah,
I was from that.
So. But now those people though, like different athletes and stuff, they were contacting you specifically or your agent about like, hey, can you come make some content for us
yeah,
for this yeah. or for the construction
the agent
company?
Slash lawyer is really only for the big documentaries.
Yeah.
For anything less than, you know, a TV documentary, I'll just do it myself. But
okay.
The
work just kind of started flowing in.
Yeah, I mean, it was honestly going well before it came out, but mm-hmm. I think that it adds a level of credibility, you know? Mm-hmm. So like when I'm saying, we're talking about the home building analogy where it's like, now I got a really nice house to show people I can build.
Yeah.
You know, and
absolutely, man.
If you got a good story, you know, we can make it happen. And also it helps to know that I can get it on TV too, because that's a whole nother animal of
yeah, I can
connections
only imagine.
And distributions and knowing the right people and knowing the industry and, you know, knowing how to make money off of it and
yep.
get it on. You know, one of the things I learned the most about this one is that I was always focused on just getting it out in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And this company that we worked with, Big Media, they're a distributor. And I think, you know, don't quote, I think they have it in like 13 or 14 different countries at this point, which I never thought about. Like, it's on Canal Plus in Spain. I don't know what Canal Plus is. I looked it up. It has 4 million subscribers. I was like, that's awesome. I didn't know
Dude.
It existed. Canal Plus.
That's amazing.
TVNZ.
So it's not just in the United States right now.
No, it actually came out overseas like a couple weeks before it came out on Roku. So
wow.
Fun. Yeah.
That's awesome. It's doing well over there overseas?
From what I've heard, yeah. I don't know. I don't talk to anyone in Spain, but I think so. Yeah.
No, that's awesome. So before we wrap it up, I want you to give me a guest. I want to interview Joe. Bad. I need you to hook that one
up. Listen, here's the thing about Joe is he is going to charge $15,000 directly wired to me. No, I'm kidding. Let's see. I could probably get Joe. Let's see.
You need to give me a guest that you can put me in contact with.
You know what we'll do is next time Joe's in Florida, mm-hmm. we'll do like, hey, my man Mitch will take you alligator hunting if you do his podcast.
For sure.
We'll do something like
that. Yeah, I can hook him up.
That'd be a fun content trip. We'll do some like alligator hunting or duck.
Duck, yeah.
Something.
I would love to take him duck hunting.
That could be cool content for him too. I could film that and do the podcast too.
I would love to take him duck hunting. Is he going to be down before December though? Or November?
Maybe. It all depends on what happens with this fight. You know, as
soon
as you win, you could be injured. You know.
Yeah, I really hope he's not.
Yeah. So
maybe Joe, maybe Mike.
Yeah, my father-in-law, my wife's dad. He's a very good guy to have on. He's got a million stories, and he's had a real Saul to Paul transformation in his life. He has his BC days and his AD days.
Yeah, I would love to talk to him about that.
No, he's a great guy
for sure. Anything else do you have that you'd like to say to somebody looking to get into film?
Can't care what anyone else thinks about you. Everyone, it's the pop. I would love to sit here and say, like, I don't care what anyone thinks of me. Of course I do.
It's in the back of my mind, too.
I want Mitch to think I'm cool, you know? But, like, at the end of the day, who cares if Mitch thinks I'm cool?
No doubt.
But I want, you want to be a people pleaser, but, like,
for sure.
You can't, you know? You know,
just stay true to yourself.
A lot of people are more concerned with their own lives than worried about what you're doing. So, mm-hmm. you know, I'll even tell people of like, you know, I could probably repost. I made a few Instagram reels last year, like some of them are really good. I wish I could repost them. Like, you know, Chandler, you know who noticed if you reposted it? You and your wife.
Mm-hmm.
People don't care about you that much. So just do what you want to do.
Just do it.
Yeah.
Just do it and not care what people think.
Exactly. Or you will regret it.
Yeah. Amazing advice.
Yes, sir.
All right, man. Thanks for doing it. Appreciate you. Thanks for tuning in to this episode of The Dash in the Middle. Please be sure to check out Chandler's documentary, Journey to the UFC, Joe Pyfer, now available on Daily Wire Plus. The best way you can support us is by following us on Spotify, Apple, and YouTube. Leave us a comment, give us a guest suggestion, and you can leave us up to a 5-star review. Thanks for watching. We'll see you in the next one.